Democratic VP pick Tim Walz addresses the nation.
But when we Democrats talk about freedom, we mean the freedom to make a better life for yourself and the people that you love. Freedom to make your own health care decisions.
Plus, Ukraine follows its incursion into Kursk with a drone attack on Moscow.
Also, the head of Ukrainian intelligence, Kirill Budanov, said that Ukrainian forces carried out drone attacks on a radio communication center at Moscow's Ostafyevo airport.
And later, flooding in Bangladesh and protesters storm parliament in Indonesia. Plus, just what does AI have to do with swimming? Today is Thursday, August 22nd, and this is VOA's Flashpoint. Good evening. I'm Lori London, along with Steve Karish. Minnesota Governor Tim Walz wasn't well known on the national political scene until Kamala Harris named him as her vice presidential running mate. As the Democratic National Convention closed out its third night in Chicago late Wednesday, Walz accepted his party's nomination as vice president and took the opportunity to address his party and his country. VOA Midwest correspondent Kane Farabaugh has more from Chicago.
Opening the third day of Democrats' National Convention in Chicago, U.S. Senator Cory Booker from New Jersey outlined the night's theme.
Welcome to night three. And tonight is about freedom.
While some of the programming provided speakers opportunities to address topics including reproductive rights, environmental issues, and border security, much of the messaging focused on what Democrats say is the choice in the November election.
Kamala Harris, for the people. And the other guy who's proved even more than the first go-around that he's about me, myself, and I.
Former President Bill Clinton was one of the most anticipated speakers of the evening. Clinton, who has attended every convention for Democrats since 1972, drew from his own experience in the White House to explain why he believes Vice President Kamala Harris is the best choice for president.
Kamala Harris will work to solve our problems, seize our opportunities, ease our fears, and make sure every single American, however they vote, has a chance to chase their dreams.
But the key moment for Democrats was hearing from Minnesota Governor Tim Walz, who accepted his party's nomination as vice president.
It's the honor of my life to accept your nomination for vice president of the United States.
For many in the crowd and those watching the convention around the country, Walz's speech was a sort of introduction.
Now, I grew up in Butte, Nebraska, a town of 400 people. I had 24 kids in my high school class, and none of them went to Yale. But I'll tell you what, growing up in a small town like that, you learn how to take care of each other.
Walz, a military veteran, former teacher, and American high school football and basketball coach, highlighted how these parts of his personal biography prepared him for a life in politics.
But it was those players and my students who inspired me to run for Congress. They saw in me what I had hoped to instill in them, a commitment to the common good, an understanding that we're all in this together, and the belief that a single person can make a real difference for their neighbors.
As the final speaker, Walz punctuated the freedom theme of the night.
But when we Democrats talk about freedom, we mean the freedom to make a better life for yourself and the people that you love. Freedom to make your own health care decisions. And yeah, your kids' freedom to go to school without worrying about being shot dead in the hall.
Democrats wrap up this convention on Thursday evening with a marquee moment: the acceptance speech of the party's nominee, Vice President Kamala Harris. Kane Farabaugh, VOA News, from the Democratic National Convention in Chicago.
Pro-Palestinian protests continue outside the DNC in Chicago as diplomatic efforts to bring a ceasefire to the war in Gaza are also continuing around the globe. President Joe Biden told Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu that a deal is of utmost importance, and the upcoming talks in Cairo are crucial to make that happen. Ryan Chang of Reuters has more.
Free, free, free Palestine!
Protests for a Gaza ceasefire and ending funding to Israel grew larger outside the Democratic National Convention on Wednesday. An uncommitted Iowa delegate, Newman Abuisa, was in amongst the pro-Palestinian protesters and says ending fighting in the Middle East should be a top priority for the Democrats.
I'm glad our candidate Kamala Harris boycotted the meeting of Benjamin Netanyahu for Congress. I'm glad that she had a press conference and talked about the Palestinian suffering. That is great. Those are great steps. But in the next few weeks, we need a ceasefire in the Middle East. We need a ceasefire to stop the killing of the children. And that will get my vote.
Facing growing pressure at home, Biden has made getting a ceasefire deal in Gaza a major priority. A senior U.S. official on Friday said a deal was within reach, but a final agreement has been agonizingly elusive. In a phone call Wednesday, Biden stressed to Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu the urgent need to conclude a Gaza ceasefire for hostages deal. Biden also reportedly said talks in the coming days in Cairo between negotiators were crucial in removing any remaining obstacles. This came after State Secretary Antony Blinken ended his trip to the Middle East on Tuesday without an agreement between Israel and Hamas militants. In talks to halt fighting in the 10-month-old war, Hamas wants a complete Israeli withdrawal from Gaza. However, Israel wants to retain control of the so-called Philadelphia Corridor, where it uncovered several weapon smuggling tunnels after capturing it in late May. A White House statement said Biden and Netanyahu discussed U.S. efforts to support Israel against all threats from Iran, including its proxy terrorist groups Hamas, Hezbollah, and the Houthis. Iran has vowed retaliation over the killing of Hamas leader Ismail Haniyeh in Tehran, which it blames on Israel. Israel hasn't confirmed nor denied it was behind the killing.
That's Ryan Chang of Reuters reporting for us today.
And now to Europe. Following Ukraine's surprisingly effective incursion into Russia's Kursk region, Kyiv launched a drone attack in Moscow. We hear more from VOA's Anna Chernikova in Kyiv.
Ukrainian media, citing sources in the Ukrainian Special Service, reported that Ukrainian intelligence organized an attack on the Russian Savosleka military airfield in Nizhny Novgorod region of Russia, from which Russian forces are launching MiG aircraft to attack Ukraine. According to the sources, as a result of the attack, 3 aircraft were destroyed and about 5 aircraft were damaged. Currently, there is no video material or official confirmation of this information. Also, the head of Ukrainian intelligence, Kirill Budanov, said that Ukrainian forces carried out drone attacks on a radio communication center at Moscow's Ostafyevo airport and the Milerovo air base in the Rostov region. According to Budanov, on August 21st, intelligence officers conducted several drone operations, though the level of damage is still being assessed. On August 18th, Ukrainian drones struck an oil depot in Proletarsk in Russia's Rostov region. That fire is still burning, and the Russian service of Radio Liberty reports the number of injured firefighters has increased to 49. According to the local authorities, about 20 tanks with diesel fuel with a volume of 5,000 cubic meters each caught fire. As of August 20th, the burning area was 10,000 square meters. Meanwhile, President Volodymyr Zelensky visited the border areas of the Sumy region on Thursday. There, he met with Commander-in-Chief Alexander Sirsky and the head of the Sumy military administration. In his latest address, Zelensky said that Ukraine continues its operation in the Kursk region.
Наша операція в Курській області триває.
He did not provide additional details on future plans of the Ukrainian forces in the Kursk region. For his part, Russian President Vladimir Putin on Thursday held a meeting with senior officials about the situation in Russian regions bordering Ukraine. Acting Kursk governor Alexei Smirnov said that more than 133,000 people had left or been evacuated from his region. Also, Putin accused Ukraine of an attempt to attack the Kursk nuclear power plant, which is located close to the areas Ukrainian forces are currently controlling. VOA cannot verify the information about the nuclear power plant attack independently. Anna Chernikova, VOA News, Kyiv.
Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi urged diplomatic efforts to end the war in Ukraine during a visit to neighboring Poland on Thursday, pledging India's support and saying that no conflict can be solved on a battlefield.
Ukraine aur Paschim Asia mein chal rahe sangharsh hum sabhi ke liye.
Modi said that India supports dialogue and diplomatic effort for the restoration of peace and stability as soon as possible. Modi and Poland's Prime Minister Donald Tusk met for talks on security, India's strategic partner Russia, and invigorating bilateral ties. Later, the Indian leader was to meet with Poland's President Andrzej Duda. Ahead of his visit, Modi said Poland was India's key economic partner in Central Europe. On Friday, Modi travels to Kyiv to meet with President Volodymyr Zelensky. Kyiv has previously chastised Modi for a visit to Moscow last month, a trip during which he met with and hugged Vladimir Putin.
You're listening to Flashpoint from the Voice of America. I'm Lori London with Steve Karish in Washington. Indonesian lawmakers Thursday canceled plans to ratify controversial revisions to the country's election laws after thousands of protesters rallied in front of the parliament building. Demonstrations broke out across the country against the planned changes. At one point, security forces fired tear gas and water cannons to disperse crowds who had attempted to storm the parliament building after they tore down a section of fence and threw rocks at police.
The UN says intensifying hostilities in the ongoing conflict in Myanmar is creating a deteriorating humanitarian situation and massive displacement. UN spokesperson Stefan Dujarric.
Notably in Mong Dao Township on the border with Bangladesh on August 5th, an estimated 20,000 people were reportedly displaced from three downtown Mong Dao wards. There are also reports of more people crossing into Bangladesh. In northern Shan, there's been a resurgence of fighting since late June, with an estimated 33,000 people displaced from four townships.
Speaking to reporters Thursday, Dujarric said torrential monsoon rains since June are also aggravating the already dire situation.
Some 393,000 men, women, and children have been impacted by this flooding.
And the relentless monsoon rains and flooding in neighboring Bangladesh have stranded nearly 3 million people where vast areas have been submerged. Television footage on Thursday showed strong torrents of gushing water, roads severely inundated, and stranded people being rescued with ropes. Forecasters are warning that with rains continuing, water levels could rise further over the next 24 hours.
Japan is set to have a new prime minister after incumbent Fumio Kishida announced last week he would not seek re-election in the Liberal Democratic Party leadership vote next month. Kishida sought to transform Japan's security capabilities amid growing regional threats. But will his successor seek to build on that legacy? Details from Henry Ridgewell in Tokyo.
Japan's outgoing Prime Minister Fumio Kishida marked the 79th anniversary of his country's defeat in World War II on August 15th. Kishida said Japan must never again repeat the devastation of war, but his speech also reflected Japan's changing role on the global stage.
Japan will do its utmost to resolve the various challenges facing the world.
Kishida sought to transform Japan's defense posture. He warned that Ukraine today may be East Asia tomorrow and forged close ties with Kyiv, visiting the country in 2023 before hosting Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky at the G7 summit in Hiroshima. Kishida's policies included doubling defense spending by 2027, developing closer regional alliances, and upgrading the United States military command in Japan. His successor will likely continue Kishida's approach, says analyst Tomohiko Taniguchi.
Because of the troubling neighborhood that Japan finds itself in, Russia, North Korea, and China, three of the nuclear-powered nations, and none of which has exercised anything akin to open democracy, and three of those countries are all fostering hostility and hate intentionally and institutionally towards Japan and the U.S.-Japan alliance.
Japan's Kishida and South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol overcame historical grievances to forge a close alliance. In a joint statement Sunday, the United States, Japan, and South Korea reaffirmed their pledge to jointly tackle regional challenges made a year ago at an historic Camp David summit. But uncertainties remain, Taniguchi says.
President Yoon has passed the midpoint of his term. The rest of his term is going to be increasingly a lame duck administration. The opposition parties are sniffing blood already, and the easiest target for the opposition party is to say that the incumbent administration is too weak vis-a-vis Japan.
Japan's next prime minister will also have to win the approval of the Japanese public. Professor of International Relations at the University of Tokyo, Yi Kuang-heng.
I think the public supports, in principle, boosting Japan's defences and the defence budget hikes, but they are actually unwilling to pay higher personal taxes in order to do so.
United States Ambassador to Japan Rahm Emanuel wrote on X that Kishida had helped build a latticework of security alliances and partnerships across the Indo-Pacific region that will stand the test of time. Beijing, meanwhile, said it would work to build a constructive and stable China-Japan relationship with Kishida's successor. Henry Ridgewell, VOA News, Tokyo.
A State Department official was in Nigeria this week for crucial meetings with local authorities and the regional bloc ECOWAS on military use of artificial intelligence and issues related to technology. Timothy Obeziu reports from Abuja on the meetings with Mallory Stewart. She's the Assistant Secretary of State for the Bureau of Arms Control, Deterrence and Stability.
Mallory Stewart's two-day visit to Nigeria was part of the United States' commitment to deepen security cooperation in Africa. Stewart met in Abuja with Nigerian officials and officials from the regional bloc ECOWAS to advance conversations on the responsible use of artificial intelligence in military applications. She spoke to journalists on Wednesday.
The U.S. government has been working with right now 55 other countries, hopefully more, including some African nations, to agree upon the responsible uses of AI in the military context, right? So it's sort of using AI in a manner consistent with international law, recognizing inherent human bias.
In the last decade, sub-Saharan Africa, including Nigeria, has seen an increase in violence perpetrated by numerous armed groups. It is not clear if these groups are already using AI against governments like Nigeria's. Last year, the Global Terrorism Index report named the region a global epicenter of terrorism, accounting for nearly 60% of terror-related deaths. Nigerian authorities have been pushing for the integration of artificial intelligence in military operations, while acknowledging that adopting AI will require Africa-specific policies that address concerns. Security analyst Kabiru Adamu of Beacon Consulting says the use of AI in military operations has advantages.
Given the position of the U.S. in terms of its military capacity and might, and its technological advancement, it will definitely be in a position to support Nigeria's desires, especially if it's able to contextualize some of the peculiarities within the Nigerian security space.
The founder of Global Sentinel online magazine, Senator Irebu, says while AI has benefits, the technology still needs to be treated with caution.
It limits casualties in terms of the number of soldiers that will be deployed. So you conserve your boots. It helps also to penetrate maybe rough terrain, gather more intelligence. It's good that there is growing awareness of the issue of artificial intelligence, but Nigeria needs to first of all try to define its own policy and strategy with regard to artificial intelligence. More sensitization need to be done, and more policy aspect of it also need to be developed.
In June, African ministers unanimously endorsed landmark continental AI strategy to advance Africa's digital future and development aspiration. And last week, the African Union approved the adoption of AI in public and private sectors in member states, including Nigeria. Stewart says the United States will be working to ensure that concerns about the ethical use of AI are addressed and many more countries adopt the technology for its benefits. Timothy Obiezu, VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
And speaking of artificial intelligence today, AI is also being used to provide real-time water quality warnings to alert swimmers to potential health risks associated with polluted water. As Olivia Zelino with Reuters reports, it's done through sensors installed at wild swimming locations and beaches across southern England.
Here at this popular wild swimming spot in southern England, artificial intelligence is helping keep people safe. Dan Biles is checking the status of the water. With a click of a few buttons, he's told there are no current swim alerts. It's all clear to take a dip today. That water quality warning is coming from AI-powered sensors installed at wild swimming locations and beaches in the region.
What the artificial intelligence then does is takes that real-time data from the sensors and is able to use it to determine in real time the risk of harmful bacteria in the river.
Biles is with Unify Technology, the UK startup behind the sensors.
At the moment, if people want to know what's going on in their water, it's literally a sample is taken, driven off to a laboratory. 3 days later, they will tell you, by the way, you should not have been swimming last Thursday. And that's not good enough.
Unify system uses data from sensors placed upstream. They monitor various factors like pH, temperature, dissolved oxygen, and ammonia levels. Over a six-month training period, the AI learns to correlate these sensor data patterns with bacteria levels. Once fully operational, the system provides updates on water quality through their mobile app, alerting the public to potentially high levels of bacteria. It'll protect swimmers from health risks like gastrointestinal illnesses, skin, ear, and eye infections, and in some cases, more serious diseases. The initiative is part of a broader strategy to improve the health of England's waterways. Years of underinvestment by privately run, profit-seeking water companies in the UK have coincided with heavier rainfall from climate change. With a growing population, the country's water industry is close to crisis.
The state of Britain's rivers and coasts is terrible. This is not something that's happened overnight. It's a problem that's been brewing over decades. And it's not something that's going to be solved overnight. It's going to take a lot of time and effort from lots of different stakeholders in order to solve this problem.
That was Reuters correspondent Olivia Zolino reporting.
And that's going to wrap up today's show. There's more VOA coverage 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and across our social media platforms.
On behalf of Steve Karish and the entire VOA team, thank you so much for listening. Until tomorrow, I'm Lori London.
For deeper dives and expert analysis, listen to VOA Podcasts. Issues in the News explores the biggest stories every weekend, while International Edition keeps you informed every weekday. Plus, with the 5-minute newscast at the top of every hour, you're always up to date.